Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Anoush, and on today's episode of the New Statesman podcast, we talk to our executive editor, Tim Ross, about the perfect storm coming over the country just in time for Christmas.
Hi, I'm Stephen, and in part two, Anoush and I take your questions about whether or not Keir Starmer's left-wing critics are acting in good or bad faith.
So we're delighted to be joined on this episode by our new executive editor, Tim Ross. I think it's your New Statesman podcast debut, isn't it, Tim?
It is. Very exciting.
Well, welcome. Thank welcome you. To our glamorous studio.
It is certainly glamorous, and it's delightful to be here. Thanks.
Well, we've been talking for weeks now about how grim the coming Christmas could be. And now on top of that, there's an added terrifying element to our festivities, which is we could potentially be waiting for another crunch Brexit decision on Christmas Eve because the Northern Ireland Protocol is being negotiated or discussed, at least again, between the two parties. The European Commission unveiled a package of reforms to the protocol yesterday. We're recording on Thursday, and it's up to see whether the two sides entering into talks can decide whether or not the UK can accept those concessions. You've been watching this. What do you think the UK side is thinking at the moment?
Well, we've all been watching it for years and years, and it's got to the stage where it's sort of not really Christmas unless there's a Brexit crisis and a deal people are trying to do. My sense is that actually both sides are a bit closer together than all the rhetoric would leave you thinking initially, notwithstanding the fact that Dominic Cummings has inevitably lobbed his own grenade into the mix, claiming that Boris Johnson never intended to stick to the deal he signed in 2019. But behind all that heat and light and fury, there are actually, I think, quite a few points in which the two sides are close. And I think you can see that there is willingness on the European Union side to move and be more flexible in allowing the transport of goods, particularly chilled meats, the famous sausage war issue, from mainland Britain into Northern Ireland. And that's been a very big issue for unionists and for many Conservatives. Similarly with medicines, I think there's some flexibility there as well. The big issue, I think, is political. Will the Conservative Party still hold the Brexit minister, David Frost, to account for his big point, which is about the European Court of Justice? That's his big demand. His people say that it's not a new one, that the government has always been clear the European Court of Justice shouldn't have jurisdiction in Northern Ireland because there is no democratic accountability for such an operation. But the European Union clearly say that without that, there is no access to the single market because the single market is regulated by the European Court.
Yeah. And so what do you think is the likely outcome of these talks then? Because the British government are sort of making the argument, or at least it feels as if the mood around it is that they, because they've been so confrontational in these talks, they're getting what they want. So is it a sort of vindication of their strategy, and will they carry on sort of approaching it in that way?
I think they probably will. I mean, it's a really interesting point, actually, if you compare the two negotiating styles between the prime ministers and their teams over the course of the last 5 years. You had Theresa May to begin with, who wanted her famously deep and special partnership and wanted to approach the European Union pretty much in a collaborative way to try to work it out together. She sent Ollie Robbins over there, who was in the room the whole time with Sabine Weyand and trying to get a deal together. And the reality is actually that didn't work. Not only was she stuck with a hung parliament and couldn't get her deal through there, but the deal itself obviously didn't have the kind of democratic consent it needed in the UK. And in fact, whatever you say about the Johnson administration, he played a much more hardball strategy and did deliver deals, did deliver both the divorce agreement and then the trade agreement a year later. And I think there is a sense in which actually the European Union has, they won't admit it probably, but has actually shown a bit more willingness to move in the face of the kind of hardball tactics that David Frost deploys.
But of course, some of the mess that we're in now are because of those deals that were created by Boris Johnson.
They're trying to unpick it, exactly.
Yeah, and of course, there's other things catching up with him as well, which you've been writing about in this week's issue. The headline is The Perfect Storm, and it's about this crunch point of the energy crisis, the rise in prices, the supply chain crisis, all coming together. And, you know, it's only October. People probably aren't even turning their heating on yet. And the perfect storm comes from a quote from a minister who you heard from saying, you know, this is the perfect storm of all of these issues coming together. Someone else senior in Whitehall told you that there's panic around government because of the impact of what high energy prices could have on society. So all of these things that you've found out from behind the scenes contradict ministers' very sort of relaxed public approach to this, I think. So is there really a sense of panic inside government?
I think people are worried. I think you could really tell the Conservative conference. It was the issue that sort of underpinned all the debates, but never really bubbled in a very meaningful way to the surface. I mean, Sunak didn't tackle it too much in his speech. Johnson skirted over it pretty much in his speech. But around the fringes, it came up a lot. And certainly, if you talk to government advisers and special advisers and ministers behind the scenes, you got a very clear sense that this was the big worry, and they just didn't really know how it was going to go. And why could they? You know, why would they? How could they really? There are so many issues all coming together at once, causing potentially horrific political misery for the government and a very grave situation for the country and for the economy too. So I do think there are parts of government that have been panicking, particularly when you look at the impact of the gas price on potential shortage industries. I mean, it's one thing if energy bills are being hit for domestic consumers. That's never a good look for a government. It's another thing if the country starts running out of paper and glass and ceramics because these factories have to shut down. And certainly in case of glass making, for example, if you shut down a glass factory, you can't restart it again. You've got to actually rebuild the equipment, which is hugely expensive. So potentially there are long-term consequences. And if the government can't come up with the sort of solutions to all of these issues, then it could get very serious very fast.
To me, it feels like there's a sort of complacency because with the fuel crisis and the lack of HGV drivers, they sort of made a virtue of it, didn't they? They were saying, well, this is maybe painful for the short term, but it's part of our transition into this high-skilled, high-wage, new economy post-Brexit. And, you know, we're holding businesses accountable for how they treat their staff and how they recruit and what wages they pay. And there was a sense that they'd sort of played a blinder and that Keir Starmer had nowhere to go with that other than to call for sort of cheap labour from abroad. But merging that with these issues, I think, was a little bit complacent and perhaps papers over the bigger problems that are down the line that you've written about in your piece. So do you think there was a sense that they've kind of explained their way out of this issue, but reality is around the corner?
I think the reality is around the corner for the UK, but also for a lot of other countries too. It's really worth saying that the gas supply problem, or gas price problem really, is pretty much across the globe. And all sorts of issues have contributed, including a very cold winter in Asia, which sped up demand, the unlocking of economies across the planet after the coronavirus lockdowns, which has also spiked demand as well. America's struggling, lots of countries are struggling, Spain is struggling. But I think, in a way, politically, it's difficult for the UK, especially after Brexit. I think that, in a way, is the issue that really crystallises this as a crisis for Johnson and for his government, because the critics of the Johnson government really will always point to Brexit and say, it would be easier if we were in the EU. It would be easier if we could rely on our friends in Europe. And also, you've frankly made it harder, Prime Minister, by sticking to your immigration rules, which mean that a lot of low-skilled labourers who would be here are not.
And you spoke to an energy boss, didn't you? And he really didn't mince his words. Do you want to tell me a bit about that?
He didn't. It was fascinating. And actually, this doesn't have anything to do with Brexit. It was about the energy crunch and the regulation of the UK market, which is clearly a long-standing thing. But Keith Anderson, the boss of Scottish Power, was speaking at a New Statesman event, at a Labour conference. It was a roundtable event. Only a few of us were there. But he at one point was so furious with the way that the government and the regulator had sort of completely failed to regulate the system and allowed in a lot of smaller, really unviable companies, in his opinion, into the market that have now collapsed and are letting down hundreds of thousands of customers that the rest of the energy market, the other suppliers, the big six, big providers, are having to pick up. And he says that's incredibly unfair. yeah, if you pick up the magazine, you'll see some fairly colourful language in it.
Yeah. What is Christmas likely to look like then? And actually, is it a mistake for the government to be sort of seeing that as its deadline in which it just has to sort of lurch through until next year? Because we know that the visas for the workers who have been allowed to come over only expire sort of a few months after December. In a piece that I was reporting on, you know, I found that the chemicals that are used to clean our water, the rules have been relaxed on those, but only until the 31st of December, which sort of has the impression of saying we'll only have, you know, we'll only be able to clean our water until
New
Year's
Eve.
Who
needs water in 2022? Yeah. So,
you know, you hear this Christmas deadline quite a lot and you get the impression that they're just trying to sort of lurch on into next year, sort of one last push. Do you have a picture of what it might look like?
Well, I think, again, probably Boris Johnson's general critics tend to sort of see him as a bit of an essay crisis prime minister who loves a deadline and enjoys the whooshing sound they make when they fly past sort of thing. But it's not the pain. If they get through to Christmas, that will be one sort of an achievement without too much disruption. Certainly, I think the talk of power cuts is probably overdone. The question, I think, for the energy market actually is around, you know, how viable it is, how quickly to move off fossil fuels. But in terms of the picture for Christmas and the winter, that's not the end of it. I mean, the consumer pain, the squeeze on living standards and particularly people's incomes is likely to go on, I think, because inflation is obviously the big concern. That's rising. There are projections that it will hit 4%, may go higher, could last for a long time before it comes down. And that will obviously potentially prompt the Bank of England to raise interest rates too. So their mortgages will go up. And at the same time, in April, we have a new tax. The national insurance will increase to pay for health and social care. So conservatives can certainly see that this is a big problem.
Yeah. And actually, before Christmas, we, of course, have the COP summit, which was supposed to be a sort of festival on a par with the Olympics 2012. Could it be potentially embarrassing because, you know, our energy insecurity is being exposed? I know there are issues across the world with the gas prices rising, but it could potentially be a painful point during the COP summit.
It's not a great look for the host country to have been relying on one 50-year-old power station in Nottinghamshire that's due to be closed down next year to keep the lights on for a few days in September, as was the case in the UK. But Britain's not alone. Again, a lot of countries are still reliant on fossil fuels for their power. And it's a question, I think, not just for the UK. Often it gets put on Johnson's shoulders, but it's the whole world that's got to step up to the plate at COP. And China's got to act, and Australia's got to act, and Saudi Arabia has to bite the bullet in some sense. And these are all very tricky tasks for anyone. And I think, you know, Johnson is famously persuasive. He's a charismatic campaigner who's had a lot of success, but his charm might not quite extend to some of those places.
Thanks so much for coming on, Tim.
A pleasure.
If you've been enjoying our podcast and want to find out more about what we think, and some of our colleagues too, then why not subscribe to The New Statesman? You can get 12 weeks for £12. Go to newstatesman.com/subscribe12.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And now it's time for a section we like to call
You Ask Us.
So this is a question from Nathan. He asks, how legitimate are the Corbynite left's grievances with Keir Starmer? So he gives some examples in his question. For example, the perception that Starmer's betrayed the pledge to nationalise energy companies. So, Stephen, what do you think? Do you think that these criticisms have a good point, or are they made in bad faith because they never wanted Starmer to be Labour leader in the first place?
I'm going to do my favourite thing, which is say this is a good question, but then critique the question. But ultimately, in the Labour Party, is this criticism made with bad faith is basically an argument to which the answer is always yes, right? With Starmer and his left flank, you can quite literally tell this because you can put the timetable on this, right? Are they now saying they would nationalise the national grid but not the Big Six like Labour did in 2017? Are they now saying they wouldn't nationalise them at all? Are they saying that they would have a kind of Robin Hood Energy, Hackney Light and Power style publicly owned new company and they wouldn't really care about this? None of us know. And that speaks to a variety of useful criticisms of the Labour leadership. I know every time I say this, like, people get angry, but it is just a matter of fact, right? The point that people started, you know, wandering around like bears with a sore head talking about betrayal narratives was not any of the points of policy divergence. It was the sack of Becky Long Bailey. And ultimately, there are a group of people who are so invested in the idea that, you know, they did nothing wrong and then, oh, you know, what's a little broken equality law among friends? Then they have this huge investment in the idea that this is all about, you know, them being purged and whatnot. But one of the reasons why I don't think that's very useful is that one of the reasons why Labour is such a poorly run party is everyone is so obsessed with the idea of whether or not complaints are in bad faith, right? We saw this with Labour anti-Semitism, right? You just saw this kind of gradual refining down of, like, what an acceptable, fit and proper Jewish person to comment on it was. So now it's basically the 6% of British Jews who still voted Labour in 2019, not including the ones like Margaret Hodge and Ruth Smith, who very much did so through gritted teeth. So basically at that point, we are talking about 4 to 5% of that minority community. But none of that is actually that useful, I think, in the litigating of people's motives. The more useful question is always, well, look, is this criticism true? To return to the energy example, I mean, we literally don't know what Labour's position on energy is, which I would argue is a problem, however you slice it. If it turns out that at the end of it, they want to renationalise the national grid and there's some kind of new Robin Hood Energy style, that for people who aren't as cool as me, that's the name of the public energy company run by Nottingham City Council. Well, yeah, sure, they've kept the promise. Does it reflect well on the Labour leadership that we're literally sitting here going, what is their energy policy? I don't know. Ditto, right? To take, you know, another obviously silly criticism, right? They have no policies. When it is a demonstrable fact that they announce them at a stunning and counterproductive rate. Or, yeah, to cast one's mind back to the previous era, right, when Jeremy Corbyn was criticised for doing the shocking and unprecedented act of briefing favoured commentators ahead of time, you know, having media outriders. I think the reason why this matters is one of the things that the Starmer setup has been very bad at is that they don't have outriders, right? You can tell, like, when they do something like the rule changes last week, where, yeah, you have a bunch of people who we know, without wanting to name names or be indelicate about it, but people who, you know, essentially would literally criticize David Miliband policies when they were announced by Jeremy Corbyn, the kind of people who should be in the tank for a Keir Starmer leadership going, I don't get it, what's going on? I think you can draw a direct line between Keir Starmer's inability to cultivate allies in the commentariat with the incredibly silly criticisms of Jeremy Corbyn for doing this thing that every Labour leader has done before. So I think basically the criticisms of Starmer that are, you know, palpably correct are position over spy cops. Now, of course, you could argue in favour of that by saying, well, look, they want to fight the next election on crime and, you know, you just therefore have to just, like, not allow the Tories any space. So you just, except, of course, the thing you would then immediately say is, well, OK, great, but if you want to fight the election on crime, why have you yet to make an announcement on crime that you don't then immediately, like, choke space from by going, by the way, here's another public policy announcement that could emanate from basically any politician from Jeremy Corbyn to Nick Clegg. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with policy announcements than unite that swathe of public opinion. That's probably the electoral coalition Labour would need to amass to win a majority. But it doesn't need to drown out its own dividing lines every single day. So I actually think that in some ways the good faith or otherwise of Starmer's critics is kind of a bit of a dead end. The question always should be, well, look, because I don't know about you, but I feel like whenever you write something about, like, what a politician's strategy has done wrong, someone goes, but if they'd done the reverse, then people would have criticised them for that too. And it's like, yes, well, that's true, but it doesn't change the fact that whatever you do, you're going to be criticised. However, are you being criticised by people who have a point, regardless of whether or not they have arrived at that point through a nonsense process? Or are you being criticised by people who have no point? Or are you, in your criticism, again, to go back to a Corbyn-era bad faith criticism of that leadership, and I think it's had serious consequences, not just for Starmer's leadership, but I think the Labour Party will continue to regret for some time. This way, then, it basically became, you'd see people, you know, like Michael Duggar, for example, right? This is someone who had publicly on Twitter castigated Laura Kaye during the 2015 Labour leadership election. Then you have people like that going, we would never criticise the BBC, not one. And it's just like, well, OK, that's not true, is it? And there are important reasons why you shouldn't pretend that it's true. And I think it was castigated for the Corbyn leadership to operate like any Labour leadership. And now you see a new Labour leadership pulling the exact same levers, in some cases not pulling them at all, and in some cases now having to live with the fact that they have made it taboo to operate as an effective opposition party. So yeah, that was a very long-winded ramble. In my defence, I'm still slightly coldy, but what do you think?
No, I think in terms of all of these sort of beats that the criticism of the left, and I think Owen Jones has mentioned in Nathan's question, so of that high-profile Corbynite outriders, the beats of their criticism are very similar to the beats of the Labour rights criticism of Jeremy Corbyn's leadership. So you're trying to purge us all, you're betraying the party's sort of traditional values, you're turning voters off, you know, you're only talking to yourself, that's another one. You don't have enough policies. I'm not sure if that was so much a criticism of Corbyn from the Labour right, but it's certainly his policies that, like you've said many times before, weren't necessarily that different from previous administration's policies, definitely sort of caused more anger in bad faith than they should have done. So, you know, all of those things are the same, and you just feel as a commentator on this stuff that it's just because the one who they don't want to be in power is in power, and so they're using the same arguments that were used against the leader that they supported. That won't change whoever's in power. There will always be a faction who will level those criticisms. So I don't actually think that that's a particularly interesting part of it. Something that did come up during the pandemic, and let's not forget that Keir Starmer became leader sort of just as the pandemic was hitting, was we need an opposition who needs to oppose. I think that was a distinctive criticism of Keir Starmer from the left that you didn't really hear about Jeremy Corbyn, because sort of say what you will about his leadership, but apart from uncertain things like the benefits cap.
Because remember though, there was all of that, why isn't he being more oppositional on Brexit?
Yeah, Brexit, that's true, yeah. Brexit, and the lack of an actual firm policy on the benefits cap. What are you going to replace universal credit with? Which I suppose is the same criticism now of Starmer. But yeah, no, that's true. That did happen too. So I suppose it's just a function of the people who you don't want to lead the party being in power and picking at the things that you think that they're doing wrong. But there are certain criticisms that do unite people who would call themselves sort of loyal or at least supportive of Starmer and the Owen Jones left. And I think some of those are worth focusing on. So the idea, perhaps, that you're not capturing people's imagination. I know blandness or being seen as a boring lawyer, for example, is a bit of a cliche, but it definitely comes up from different voices within the Labour Party. Angela Rayner was not shy about talking about that when she did her Times interview on the eve of Labour conference. And you do hear it from people within the party who supported him as leader, who are a little bit worried watching sort of his style of leadership in contrast with someone like Boris Johnson's style of leadership, and for the Labour left in contrast with someone like Jeremy Corbyn's style of leadership. So I do think that that's one of those criticisms that you hear from different voices, which makes you think there must be something in it. And, you know, it's clear from the leadership team, you know, the speech that he gave at conference was very much trying to show that he does have an emotional side. He does have a backstory that he wants to talk about. And actually, you know, I've spoken before on the podcast about actually being moved to tears by that part of his speech. So you could see that there'd been a great deal of thinking and focus going into that. You can see what they're doing now as well, getting him to try and take the HGV driving test and visiting all of these various places and doing the politician in a hard hat pointing at things thing, which we've said before on this podcast he should be doing more of to try and get those images out there. You know, he should be the type of politician that people don't shrug their shoulders at, but people in the press laugh at because, oh, look, he's doing another photo shoot. And unless we're laughing at the things that they're doing, they're not doing them enough to sort of get through to the public enough. And I think that the bland criticism, while, you know, you can argue about how fair that word is and it is a bit of a cliche, I do think that there's more to it than bad faith.
One of the reasons why the Labour Party loses so often is you are never going to be short of reasons to dismiss a criticism because of the person who's making it. And if you run out of reasons, don't worry, you can always invent another one. And you will always, in a Labour context, have someone who is willing to support you with an ultimately doomed strategy. Now, I think the interesting intra-Labour question is a large chunk, not all of, and you know, when you'd speak to lots of people in the campaign group who'd go, I'm really worried about our internal strategy here. And one of them said, the problem we have is that, they said, Starmer's victory has resulted in the elevation of a lot of people who behaved very stupidly on the right of the party. But that only happened because Keir behaved smartly. And they said, we have this real problem that a large chunk of the campaign group has decided to emulate the Corbyn skeptic strategy without any media support, with a weaker institutional position in the Labour Party. And they said, so how do we think that's going to work out for us? Which, I mean, I think is true, right? But the Bland thing, I kind of think actually part of Starmer's problem is now them kind of, it's just like he is never ever going to be as shiny and interesting as Boris should be. They should essentially go like, our theory of this guy is, and at the end of these 4 years the country will be like, we've had quite enough of exciting experiments, and here is this guy who has spent the last 2 years with the three things that he says essentially being crime, have you noticed it's up and it's bad, climate change, have you noticed and that is bad, me, have you noticed I'm boring, and then I will not give you 4 years of crazy experiments at the end of which we still have a climate crisis and crime is still up. And I think, yeah, when you look at a lot of criticisms from his left, from his right, you're like, oh, actually, that is essentially what people are saying. We can then get into the, oh, are they really saying that because they secretly dream of a world led by Richard Bergen or a world led by Wes Streeting or a world led by Angela Rayner? Yeah, sure, maybe, but it doesn't actually change the fact that the criticism is broadly true. I mean, essentially, the problem is Labour is a really bad organisation, has a horrendous internal culture, horrendous institutional incentives. Yeah, people are just continually incentivized and encouraged to behave appallingly to one another, about one another. You know, failure is just rewarded all the time. I mean, it's, you know, it's bad. I mean, like, no wonder they lose so often. But I think one of the really interesting bits of amnesia you can see the Labour Party having at the moment is that, you know, the big difference between the 2020s and, yeah, the late 2010s and the 1980s, right? And I'm plagiarizing this opinion from a senior figure in the origins of New Labour, who, you know, they said to me, oh, well, look, the big difference was in 1983, when you were campaigning in, you know, County Durham, you'd be knocking on a bunch of doors, and there'd basically be two types of Labour voters, ones who were sticking with you because they'd always voted Labour, and ones who were sticking with you because they knew who the candidate was and they felt it was okay. They said there was absolutely no one who was enthused by Bennism. Whereas if you're knocking on the same doors in County Durham in 2019, 2017, yes, you have some people only sticking with you because they've always voted Labour. Yes, you have some people like, I'm voting for you, but, you know, fix yourself. But there is a real electoral constituency for Corbynism. Now, demonstratively, it's not large enough to take control of a country or to win a parliamentary majority. And indeed, one of the slight bits of nonsense about the 2017 election everyone kind of forgets is that if they had gained 10 more seats, then that would have still been a House of Commons that would not have been able to deliver a particularly radical agenda, and in which probably the only Labour politician who'd have been able to command a majority in the House would have been Yvette Cooper, who, whatever one thinks of her, is not exactly an avatar of radical Corbynite change. But nonetheless, right, if you want to win, yeah, that electoral coalition from Corbyn to Clegg, you do need to give something for that 10 to 13% of the country that is enthused by Corbynism. And I think one of the really interesting things that I really notice whenever I say this is then like a bunch of like Starmerite or Corbyn skeptic or whatever one wants to call them, people go like, oh, but, you know, he did this and like then Momentum did this. And it's just like, well, I'm sorry, if you think that the Labour faction is representative of the voters who are into its policy agenda, you know, you're a clown. But I think lots of people who are setting strategy or debating strategy in the Labour Party do, I think, sometimes slightly get in this like mindset of, well, of course the other side would say that. You saw this with Brexit. Of course the other side think we need to have a position. It's like, yeah, of course. However, they didn't need to have one. And Starmer does need to have something for the people who are inspired by Corbynism.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Anoush Shakelian, and my colleagues Tim Ross and Stephen Bush. We're produced by Mae Robson, and our music is Devil with the Devil, licensed under Creative Commons. Thanks so much for listening, and if you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review and don't forget to subscribe.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.